Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Telecommunications and Electronic Media Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, December 17, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group telephone conference call. On today's call, we'll be speaking with Federal Trade Commission Commissioner Maureen K. Oldhausen about privacy, the Internet, and other matters as well. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. But please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call and that we're recording today's call for use as a podcast in the future. I'm going to ask the Commissioner a few questions after very brief opening remarks, but then, as always, we'll be turning to our audience for your questions, so please be ready with those questions. Commissioner Oldhausen was sworn in as a Commissioner of the Federal Trade Commission in April 2012 to a term that expires in September 2018. Before that, she was a partner at Wilkinson Barker Knauer here, in the Washington, D.C. office. And prior to that, she served at the commission for 11 years. So she's got a great deal of experience at the commission. Prior to that, she was 5 years at the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. She's a good friend of the organization, having appeared as recently as last month at our National Lawyers Convention on one of our panel discussions that looked at the FTC and Section 5 enforcement authority. But with that, Commissioner, welcome to our program today.
Great. Thank you so much, Dean. I'm really delighted to be here today, and I really appreciate the chance to talk with the Federalist Society membership. I appreciate the role the Federalist Society plays in defending our constitutional rights and keeping up such an active and interesting debate about the nature and scope of government in the United States. What I wanted to talk about today, but I'm happy to take other topics more broadly, but was initially to focus on privacy, because that's an area where some of these concerns really are coming into a very sharp focus. What's the nature of our privacy rights, also balanced against the growth of commerce, online commerce in particular, which uses data to create new products, to advertise to people, to innovate. And so my role is to try to strike the right balance between people's rights and expectations of privacy, along with the needs of new business models that have empowered and allowed so much growth and innovation on the Internet.
Yeah, now the FTC has as long as we've had the Internet, the FTC's had a record of enforcement in the online space, especially with privacy concerns. I wonder if you can maybe start out by giving us some of the history of the FTC's statutory mandate and its involvement with the Internet, and then maybe work through to some of the more, in your mind, some of the more important recent developments in its online privacy work.
Yes, and in the interest of, you know, the FTC enforces against deceptive and unfair practices, and in the interest of avoiding deception, I should also mention that today my remarks are just my own, by the way, and they don't represent the views of the FTC or other commissioners. But with that being said, so the FTC, our authority comes from Section 5 of the FTC Act, where we have authority over unfair and deceptive acts or practices, which is our consumer protection authority, and unfair methods of competition, which is our antitrust authority. But today I'm going to talk more about our consumer protection authority. So we have primarily proceeded in the privacy area using our deception authority. So if a company makes a promise about how it's going to collect your information or use your information or share your information, and then it doesn't adhere to that promise, we can bring an enforcement action against them. And we've brought close to or about 100 deception-based cases thus far. We also have unfairness authority. And unfairness, it's interesting the way that works, is it doesn't require a statement. It doesn't require a promise that's been violated. It focuses on the harm to consumer from a particular act. So what it does is it looks at whether an act, to determine whether an act or practice is unfair, the harm has to be substantial, it mustn't be outweighed by any offsetting consumer competitive benefits, and the consumer could not have reasonably avoided the harm. And in unfairness, we have an unfairness statement where we've said that the types of harms that we would consider substantial are financial and health and safety and quiet enjoyment of the home and things involving children. So we've used our unfairness authority in about close to 50 cases now, particularly in the data security area. So that's kind of the foundation for our enforcement efforts. There are also other statutes. There's the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, there's the Fair Credit Reporting Act, and a variety of other statutes that have more particular enforcement, more particular requirements. And later on, I'll talk a little bit more about the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, which is uniquely targeted to children. But our baseline of enforcement authority is unfair and deceptive acts or practices.
Well, let's talk about COPPA a bit, the Children Online Privacy and Protection Act. You mentioned it in your remarks. It's one area you're policing under your unfairness authority. I wonder if you can say more about that, give us some background on that, and then any recent developments with that in terms of FTC's enforcement.
Yeah, so when we talk about COPPA, we're really talking about two things, which is the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, which Congress passed in 1998, and then the implementing rule, the COPPA rule that the FTC put out and has updated over time, and most recently updated again in 2012. And so what COPPA is trying to address is concerns about the collection of information about children online without their parents' notice or consent. And so, I'm a strong supporter of taking, you know, the necessary steps to protect vulnerable consumers, including children. But I also think this is an area that really calls for balance, that we need to be careful that where we draw lines will not hurt legitimate businesses on the web or on other internet-enabled services that use information to compete or to provide better services or to provide, you know, new technologies. So in the year 2000, the FTC issued the COPPA rule to enforce the act. And what it requires is it prohibits an operator of a website or an online service that's directed to children or that has actual knowledge that it's collecting personal information from a child from collecting that information without first providing notice on their site or their service about what information they're collecting and how they use it, and also getting verifiable parental consent for the use or disclosure of that information. And the Act defines a child, so it's ages under 13. So we have not tried to sweep in teenagers or older children. It's really 12 and below. So that was the requirement, and we've brought a number of enforcement actions over the years based on these requirements. We also have a safe harbor provision for it that allows industry groups or others to submit self-regulatory guidelines for FTC review about how such information, how they can get consent. So with the proliferation of online services and apps and kind of new things, COPPA was, and the rule was originally developed very much in mind with someone sitting at their desktop, going online, sort of a one-way conversation kind of thing. And obviously that's all changed with mobile handsets, with apps, with games that are, game consoles that are connected to the internet. We thought it would be appropriate to take a fresh look at the COPPA rule. So in April of 2010, the FTC asked for public comment on whether it should be changed to reflect new technologies. So we took comments. We got, I had a huge binder of them. I think there were over almost 100 comments, and very, very extensive ones. And so what did we do? What did the FTC do in response? I think one of the most important changes that the FTC made in the rule, and one that I objected to, and I'll explain later a little more in depth why I objected, is the rule was changed to expand the definition of what an operator of a website is. So initially, in the initial rule and statement of basis and purpose, it said that an operator was someone who operates the website and then collects or maintains information about children on behalf of the website. So anyway, the rule was expanded to cover what we consider plugins. So you have a website, you have an app, and it's got a functionality that's put into it, and it collects the information. And it may not share that information with the app or with the website. And we, the FTC, amended the rule to say, well, the website is still on the hook if that plugin is collecting information. The other thing that we did is expand the definition of what's personally identifiable information. So the statute had a list of different types of information, phone number, address, things like that, all geared towards being able to contact the child in the real world. But the statute specifically allowed the FTC to expand that definition to other types of information that would allow contacting a child in the real world. So when we revised the rule, we expanded the definition of personal information to cover IP addresses, geolocation information, and similar ways that you could use this information to contact a child in the real world. So that was sort of the basis of COPPA and what our most recent changes, what they did to amend the previous rule.
You mentioned some objection on your part to some of these changes. I don't know if it was the expanded definition of the operator or the expanded definition of personally identifiable information. I wonder if you want to expand on that for our audience.
Sure. So I went back to my days at the D.C. Circuit and went back to the Chevron Doctrine, where I, you know, spent many years interpreting laws and looking at agency interpretations of laws, you know, where the real baseline of Chevron is that the question is always, does the agency have the authority to interpret this statutory grant of power more expansively, or has Congress spoken to it specifically? And so in the COPPA, in the Act itself, Congress defined who is an operator, and I said they therefore set the outer boundary for the statute, and then therefore the COPPA rules reach. And going back to Chevron, the agency has to give effect to the unambiguously expressed intent of Congress. And so since Congress defined what an operator is, and this is how it defined it, it says an operator is any person who operates a website or an online service who collects or maintains personal information from or about users or visitors, and or on whose behalf such information is collected and maintained. So I objected to the rule and dissented to it because what the amendments did is they expanded this definition of operator to cover a site who wasn't collecting the information and where the information wasn't really collected or maintained on their behalf. So that was the plug-in issue. So I thought that even with all good intentions, it had been expanded beyond what Congress gave us the authority to say what an operator is.
Was that so despite perhaps even a personal inclination to go that way, you felt that the commission was going beyond the reach of the statute?
Yes.
With regard to definition of operator, did you have the same view with regard to the other expansion of the definition of personally identifiable information or not?
I did not, because the statute itself gave the FTC the leeway or latitude to expand the definition of personal information, because it enumerated some types, and then it talked about or other types of information that allow access or, you know, contact of a child in basically the real world. And so I thought we had that latitude to look at, well, how has technology changed? What are the, you know, new ways that you could still reach a child in the real world? And so something like an IP address could certainly still be used. It tells you as much often as a street address does. Geolocation information, some of that can be very precise, can pinpoint exactly where a person is. So to me, that was still within the latitude Congress had granted us within the COPPA statute itself.
I wonder then if your fellow commissioners have responded to your dissent, at least officially. And then I also wonder about a response from industry, not necessarily to your dissent, but to the expansion and the changes in the rules.
They didn't respond to my dissent directly. They did invite me up to the event at the Hill where we announced the rule, which I thought was very gracious of them since I had dissented on it. But I think my impression was everyone understood where I was coming from, that I appreciated all staff's hard work. I mentioned it in my statement, and the great expertise that they had in the area of children's privacy and the deep understanding of the important values at stake here. So I just couldn't go beyond exactly what Congress told us an operator should be, and I think that was understood. Now, as for industry, we have heard concerns being expressed about what may ultimately be the effect on the availability of children's content. If it is hard for an app developer to understand what its liability is going to be, if it puts a plug-in in its functionality or a site, that may mean that they just don't venture into the area of creating children's content. And I'm not sure that that really makes the world of children better off. If this is a rule that's geared at protecting children, and its effect is ultimately to reduce the amount of content available to children online or through apps, that may not really have struck the right balance in my case. And those are some of the concerns that we've heard from industry, where they're saying, well, look, these are small startups. This is not a particularly lucrative area, apps or content geared towards children. And so there may just be less of it. We've heard from some educational sites where they're particularly concerned about this. So I think that's one of the concerns that we've had expressed. Now, I will say the FTC, that's not totally fallen on deaf ears. We have tried to provide guidance to small startups, to small businesses, to app developers. And so we've put out one of the great things the FTC does. I talked already about our enforcement work. We actually do a lot of consumer education and business education. And business education in particular in this area has been, I think, a good effort on our behalf. So we put out a six-step compliance plan for businesses, simple steps that they can do to determine if their company is a website or an online service that collects personal information from kids under 13, explain they have to post a privacy policy that complies with COPPA, that tells them they have to notify parents before collecting the personal information from their kids, they have to get verifiable consent and then honor the parents' rights, and then how they implement reasonable procedures to protect the security of the kids' information. And also explains what some of the exceptions to the parental consent requirements are. So it's a very simple document. It's only 14 pages. It's available. It's got big type. Okay, it's not 14 pages of dense type. It's 14 pages of a fairly clear, simple step. So we are trying to minimize the impact on business, to try to get the balance in the right place so we don't ultimately reduce the amount of child-directed content that's available.
Right. Yeah, turning back again to your dissent, which I think is probably of great interest to our members, where the members here tend to be concerned with overreach. That's one of our major new initiatives at the Federalist Society. That is where an agency surpasses the extent of its statutory authority or otherwise tries to do too much. Has anyone challenged the new COPPA rule in court?
I'm not aware that there's been a challenge in court, but we haven't actually brought an enforcement action under the new rule yet. So I would imagine that once we take that step, then that might trigger a challenge. So it would have to be an as-written challenge thus far rather than an as-applied challenge. So I think it may still happen down the road when we bring an enforcement action that is under one of the revised provisos in the in the rule.
Mm-hmm. What about next steps? And I want to remind the audience we're going to be turning to you for your questions momentarily, but what about next steps? What else needs to be done here? And is it the job of the FTC? Is it somebody else's job? And what would you like to see the FTC doing going forward?
So I think one of the important next steps that we should do, and one that I've tried to undertake myself, is to try to reach out to the tech community, to developers, not just sit back and say, oh, I've got this stuff on the FTC website, you know, come and find it, because that may not be where they gather their information. So I've been out to Silicon Valley a few times and went to a place that is an incubator for startups. And met with a bunch of startup companies and was hearing from them sort of where to, it's not that they don't care about this, they're not even that aware of it, and even if they are aware of it, they don't really know how to go about pulling that, implementing that into their product when they're, you know, the prototypical two guys in a garage trying to figure this stuff out. So one of the things they suggested is that we try to really reach out to this community where they gather information. So just a few weeks ago, I actually did a Reddit that focused on privacy and Ask Me Anything Reddit to try to reach out to this community. I'm going to try to do a few more things like that in the coming year as I said, not just say, well, you know, this stuff is available and your big Washington law firm should keep up with the FTC website and send you updates. It's not where that community gathers information. So I think that's a big part of what the FTC needs to do is we've made our decision. We've, you know, even though I dissented, it's the rule of this new FTC rule. So we need to try to explain it and minimize the impact on business as much as possible so that we get the benefits for consumers, the benefits for children with a minimal impact on business. So I would say those are the important next steps is to continue to try to explain where the lines are now.
Very good. Let's open the floor to questions. In a moment, we're all going to hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that, if you have a question for Commissioner Olhausen, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for Commissioner Olhausen, our lines are completely open. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone while we're waiting to see who might ring in with a question. I wonder if you want to talk a little bit more generally about online and data privacy and what we could expect to see from the FTC in the next, you know, 12 months or 18 months going forward.
Sure. I've talked a lot today about COPPA, but that is a small part of our overall privacy agenda, which involves, I mentioned, enforcement. We also have research capabilities. We have a data broker study underway. We'll be gathering information about how data brokers collect and use and secure information about consumers. Some of the other things, we really try very hard to keep up with new technology. So we just did an Internet of Things workshop recently, and I spoke at that and had spoken on the topic previously. And what I was trying to stress is there can be huge benefits from the Internet of Things, incredible benefits for consumers as our devices really start to talk to each other and to have the collection and use and analysis of data sort of drive a lot of everyday decisions can be very beneficial in areas like health information technology, you know, things like remote monitoring of people in their homes with, you know, your car now is going to be collecting information. I go to a Consumer Electronics Show every year, and it's amazing the number of devices that are coming down the road. But as those things all get developed and implemented, to keep in mind some of the basics on if we brought a case against an Internet-enabled camera that had been advertised as being good for home security, home surveillance, watch your kids at home. Well, it had a very obvious software flaw that allowed anyone with the IP address to get into that feed of that camera. and there were over 700 live feeds posted online of things like kids playing in their homes and babies sleeping in their cribs, and so the FTC brought a case against that. But that's the kind of concerns, kind of activity that really raises big concerns in connection with the Internet of Things, which is, you know, surveillance in your home. So we brought a case that that's the kind of thing that I think industry really needs to pay careful attention to, so it doesn't create a bad sense around the technology while it's still kind of in its infancy. So so that was one of the things we talked about. We also talked about how much the Internet of Things is going to be relying on information collected from your handset, which you take with you everywhere. It tells you, you know, how fast you're driving down the road. It says what the ambient temperature is, where you are, what the noise level is, and many, many other things. And I talked about a case that we had brought for an app that had collected without consent all the content of people's address books. So when you download it on your phone, what you didn't realize, it was also exporting all this data out from your phone without your knowledge or consent. So those are the kinds of things, the kinds of principles that we need to keep in mind when we're talking about this great potential through the Internet of Things. There are still these baseline kinds of privacy protections that everybody should bear in mind.
Once again, we're speaking with FTC Commissioner Maureen Olhausen. And if you have a question for the commissioner, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are open. How much do you hear about from other commissioners? Are they reaching out to the industry you're seeking to regulate here? I imagine that's extremely well received by the business community. They want to know what the parameters are to the extent they can be well defined. Are the other commissioners trying to do the same, or do you have a sense of that?
No, I think they are. We all get a lot of invitations, and so I think other commissioners have been active. We all have our own unique views, and that's why we have a commission to have sort of a diversity of viewpoints. I mean, one thing that's really brought privacy very much to the forefront, a very hot-button issue these days, is certainly all the Snowden revelations. So I had the I'll put pleasure in air quotes that you can't see, of attending the Data Protection Authority's conference in Warsaw, Poland last fall, and Commissioner Brill attended as well, where we and the other U.S. government officials got quite an earful about the U.S. and our privacy laws and, you know, concerns about spying. And so I was glad, as Woody Allen says, 90% of success in life is just showing up. And showing up at this conference and speaking with the Europeans, with other, you know, members of European Parliament and business and industry and civil society groups who are concerned about this has really elevated all the privacy issues very much. So one of the things that I've been glad to see, I don't know how much people in the audience follow the safe harbor issue. So we exchange information with the EU under provisions of a safe harbor agreement where data can be transferred to the U.S. as long as the company that is handling the data has said that it has adequate protections. So it's an adequacy determination, adequate protections in place that would meet the European standards. And that came up for pretty harsh criticism in light of the Snowden revelations. And so that has been a pretty active dialogue between the U.S. and the EU, the FTC playing an important role there. The EU recently said that they would keep the safe harbor, but they want to see about updating some parts of it, giving more extensive rights to Europeans under it. But that is something that I think, you know, it will be good for U.S. businesses, good for U.S. consumers, that we'll be able to maintain that. But that is something that I know I was involved in, Commissioner Brill was involved in, Chairwoman Ramirez has been involved in. We've all, you know, there's enough work to go around on that one. So it is something that all the commissioners have been paying, and the FTC itself has been paying very close attention to make sure, again, that the balances are struck in the right place in a way that safeguards consumers' rights, but also allows business innovation to take place.
Yeah, that seems to be the big challenge facing the FTC in this area. I mean, I hear every day from folks that the internet is the one thing positively driving our economy, and it's traditionally viewed as having developed without a lot of government intervention. So I appreciate the challenge you face there. Your mention of the European Union, I don't know if you want to leave the privacy arena momentarily, but it brings to my mind some of the dissonance that I've heard about and read about in terms of enforcement regimes in the United States and in the European Union when it comes to antitrust matters. I think that reaches beyond the scope of this call, but I don't know if you want to say anything about the Commission's work in that area and what we can expect going forward. You want to share your thoughts on that?
Absolutely. I do a lot of work in that area as well, in the antitrust area of convergence of antitrust review systems around the world and convergence toward a model that is pro-competitive, that is very focused just on competitive factors, and that can foster business growth and innovation. And so we have a fairly close relationship with the EU antitrust enforcers. We don't agree on everything all the time, but we've had a long dialogue. One of the things that the FTC has been heavily involved in and has just, I think, paid a big dividends is the International Competition Network, which is it started small, and I think it's up over 127 antitrust enforcers around the world right now, where it helps to promulgate best practices for antitrust enforcement regimes. I've done a lot around the world on that. We are encouraging the Chinese to join in. We'll see if we have any luck with that. And actually, I've made 3 trips to China this year personally to talk to them about antitrust enforcement. But I do have a hook of pulling privacy and antitrust together. I was just in Brussels on December 6th giving a speech on competition, consumer protection, and the right approach to privacy, because some of the concerns about privacy have prompted some to suggest that as part of an antitrust review, we should include privacy values as part of that, a concern that if you have 2 entities that are merging and they have different databases and you put them together, could that have a privacy impact, and should that be considered as part of an antitrust review? And in my view, I don't think that it would be a good approach. I think that antitrust laws and consumer protection laws, they're both very important, but they're complements, and one isn't a substitute for each other. So I would be concerned about using a non-competition value in an antitrust review because, truthfully, where do you stop? Because if you say, well, non-competition factors, non-economic efficiency factors should be included, we may say privacy. Another country might say indigenous innovation. Another country might say, well, you're hurting our manufacturers here, or there's employment effects. And then how do you cut that off? So I would be very concerned about that. Now, on the other hand, I do think that we need to look to competitive markets as a way to give consumers different options on privacy. There are products now that are starting to compete based upon their privacy offerings. And in my speech, I talked about the search engine DuckDuckGo, which one of its benefits is it says that your searches won't be tracked. It's not used. The information isn't collected to use for tracking or behavioral advertising. And it has seen its phenomenal growth. I think certainly as online privacy has become a hotter and hotter issue, that's its comparative advantage. That's what it's been doing, and we've seen a really strong consumer response there. So competition can certainly be a way to offer consumers a greater array of privacy choices. And so preserving a competitive marketplace can ultimately serve consumer privacy goals. And certainly consumer protection enforcement can as well, and I've already talked about some of that. But I would be concerned about importing non-competition values into an antitrust analysis. So I gave that speech in Brussels on December 6th, and I was pleased that it actually seemed fairly well received by the Europeans. So I was glad about that.
We're speaking with FTC Commissioner Maureen Olhausen. If you have a question for the commissioner, we've got quite a few people on the line. We do have one question, but if you'd like to ask a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our audience now.
Commissioner Olhausen, you've been talking a little bit about antitrust, and so I actually had a question about sort of how the FTC works together with, or maybe there are some distinctions between the antitrust work at the Commission and the antitrust division at the Department of Justice.
Yes, so we have overlapping authority to enforce the antitrust laws. So the FTC Act incorporates under Section 5, the Sherman Act, and that we also enforce the Clayton Act. The only authority we don't have is over common carriers or in the criminal sphere. So for mergers, for a lot of conduct work, the FTC and the Department of Justice share authority. And the way we've typically shared that authority is through sort of an informal agreement based on subject matter expertise. So there are certain industries. The FTC does a whole lot in pharmaceuticals. We do a lot in hospitals. We do a lot in oil and gas. The Department of Justice, it has, I think we have software, they have hardware, right? We have, I'm trying to remember this right. We have spirits, they have wine and beer. I mean, so, and sometimes it gets down to rather fine distinctions. Oh, someone's telling me we have a distinction between cars and trucks, too. But anyway, so that's how we do. We have lots of conversations with them. So most of the time it works rather well. Occasionally there might be something where one side or the other would like it, and we have to have a discussion and decide who ultimately ends up with it. But that's how we generally share information. Now, one thing I have been worried about is, so I mentioned that we have authority to enforce the antitrust laws under Section 5 of the FTC Act. One thing that has been a big point of discussion is whether our unfair methods of competition authority under Section 5 expands beyond the boundaries of the antitrust laws. So would be a place where the Department of Justice couldn't bring an action, wouldn't have authority, but we would. And I'm concerned about an expansive use of unfair methods for many reasons, but one of the reasons being creating a conflict between us and the Department of Justice such that there might be, and as much as it's an institutional conflict, it creates a much bigger problem for business, because if their behavior, so I said we share antitrust authority, we engage in this clearance process. But if there is a difference between what triggers substantive liability based on whether the FTC reviews the issue or the Department of Justice reviews the issue, that turns something that right now is a matter of administrative convenience based on this, you know, industry expertise into something that creates a difference on liability. And I'm very concerned about that. So I gave a speech this summer about Section 5 called Principles of Navigation, where I talked about some of these concerns. And I would be concerned about the FTC interpreting its Section 5 authorities broadly in a way that created this institutional conflict with DOJ and this confusing state of play for industry that their behavior is illegal if the FTC looks at it, but it's something the Department of Justice wouldn't be able to reach.
All right, we've got another question from our audience. If you'd like to join the queue for audience questions, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi. I'm not quite clear on the issue of plugins and trackers and how that interacts with sites. Now, I wonder if you could explain that a bit.
Sure. So an app or a website may have content, and then it may have a functionality that it has created by putting in a plugin that does something like, you know, the like button or the, you know, something else similar to that give some kind of functionality. And the site or the app itself is not, so this is all having to do with children's information. So the site or app itself is not collecting the information from children. This plugin is. And the site may not even know that it's collecting this information. And
in fact, the plugin might come from something like Facebook. From having signed into Facebook at some time, it may have placed a plug there and a plugin there or a tracker, and it's just because it's stuck in your browser somewhere and you don't even know it, and the website doesn't know it.
Right. So the website it would know that it had a plugin, but it may not know the information that the plugin is collecting. And so the question is, if the plugin, all right, so if the plugin knows that it's collecting information about children, it's already liable under COPPA, right? So if you are a site or a service, an online service, and you have knowledge that you're collecting children's personal information, you are already on the hook under COPPA. So if the plugin is doing it, they are already liable. What the rule did, the amendment to the rule did, is make the app or the website liable for what the plugin is doing, even if the plugin isn't collecting the information on behalf of the website.
Even if the plugin doesn't come from that website, but may come from the last website you browsed?
Well, no, it would have to be the plugin was something that was part of the app or part of the website.
Now, there's an app called Ghostery, which enables you to see which plugins are trying to run on your site and blocks a lot of them if you is that pretty comprehensive about being able to call out which plugins are looking at you?
Is there
a lot of stuff?
Yeah. No, I've seen Ghostery demonstrated, and I actually mention it in some speeches, as a, sort of a market response to some of these concerns. And Ghostery is a good, I think, personally, a good tool to identify what scripts are running and where the information is going and, to give you a little look behind the curtain on what the website is collecting. So I find that to be one of the tools. I mean, there are also self-regulatory tools that are out there that are available to consumers for consumers who are concerned about this, to give them some tools and some options for them to address it. And, Ghostery is a fairly interesting one.
Now, when a site has a plugin originating in the site, does that happen by default with some program they loaded up? Or, I mean, how does a novice website owner know that they've got plugins operating within their site?
So, I mean, that's a good question. So they should know what the plugin is, right? Because it's this little functionality that they're putting these things together. It's going from, to use an analogy, more from like all designed by hand to more of a Legos approach where you're adding this functionality by snapping this, piece on. And so that the plugin would be akin to adding that other Lego on.
So you might think you're just counting the visitors to your site, but in actuality, this particular counter site may be, or counter app may be sending all the client information to some third-party data sale company.
That's right. That's right. They may be
yeah.
collecting information. And you should have an obligation to know kind of what information is being, if somebody is importing all of that out of your site. But the question is really, in the COPPA space, child-directed, right? So my concern, and I talk about this in my statement, is, all right, if the third-party plugins are child-directed or they have knowledge they're collecting children's personal information, they're already covered. If the website is child-directed and knows it has or knows it's collecting children's information, it's already covered. The expansion of the rule is to reach particularly focused on behavioral advertising, and I think that was really driving a lot of this, is to say for child-directed websites that are not collecting children's information, but they incorporate 30 third-party plugins that collect such information, to put that website then on the hook for liability. So it's a way to reach the plugin through someone who may not really be the information, they're not collecting children's information, and the information isn't being collected on their behalf, and it just doesn't meet the statutory definition.
Now, what sort of penalties is an inadvertent data collector going to be liable for one of these plugins that he didn't realize was doing what it's doing?
Right. So, you know, if you violate the COPPA rule, I think you are liable for civil penalties. And I don't remember the amount right now, $16,000 per instance.
Is that a maximum or a I mean,
no,
that means
not
every child.
It's not per incident. It's per instance. So it could be per day.
Per plug-in or per child who clicked it or per child who visited the site?
We have prosecutorial discretion to set the amount.
Can the website owner implead the plug-in provider and shunt the liability off onto the plug-in provider?
They would both. I mean, it's possible they might both have liability.
Yeah.
But what the expansion of this rule definitely says, you know, the website owner who has a plug-in and that plug-in is collecting children's information is on the hook. So what it's trying to do, in my opinion, is push the website to not have plug-ins that may collect information about children, to push the responsibility down to the website.
Suppose you set up a website before these rules came into effect and you sort of forgot about it. Are you liable for something that you did last year that was perfectly legal that has now become illegal?
So once the rule went into effect in July, you would be liable. Now, one of the things we did say we would do is to give industry time to get up to speed on this, and we sent out a number of warning letters and guidance letters because we're not trying to play gotcha on this. What I believe the agency would like is for people to change to comply with the rule and rather than have an enforcement action on the first day when somebody maybe miss the memo or something on that. So
yeah, or even miss the fact that the rule even exists. There's another great tool called Web of Trust, and users of Web of Trust can actually rate sites. One of their categories is this a site oriented for children, which I don't quite know what to make of. Does that mean that children can view this site without being scandalized or traumatized, or does it mean that this is a site that appeals to children? But it does have a child safe rating, which somehow is generated by the users. And I'm kind of wondering how that sort of thing fits in, how this tracking is reflected on the Web of Trust rating, and if you've given any thought to that.
I'm personally not familiar with the Web of Trust, but I think that your example does bring up one of the good parts that we need to pay attention to at the FTC, which is the role of market-based solutions or consumer education, and it doesn't all have to come from the FTC. So we do try to partner with a lot of organizations who are trying to give consumers additional information and additional tools to manage their privacy preferences or their children's privacy preferences as they see fit. So, for example, in the online behavioral advertising space, we have the Digital Advertising Alliance that I think has done a lot to offer consumers information about online behavioral advertising and options to opt out of receiving targeted advertising. And that could apply for children as well. And a lot of these self-regulatory organizations also talk about that they won't target advertise to children. So that's another path towards, you know, getting to what I think is a worthy goal, which is to give children some protection online, to give their parents more control about what information is being collected about the child and how it's being used, which, you know, all worthy values, but making sure that we do it in a way that doesn't hurt legitimate business and that maintains the incentive to create content for children. And I think some other options could also help help push in that direction.
The uncertainty of what appeals to children, for example, depictions of skateboarders, depictions of cute kitty cats, there are all sorts of things which might be regarded as very appealing to children, but might not be especially appealing. I mean, there are certainly people who like to look at cute kitty cats who are not children, and so how does it seems to me you've got a huge penalty being imposed on people by a matter of interpretation that people could be not under any warning of. Other questions arise. If you post something on YouTube, are you as your own YouTube video? Is YouTube running things that might infringe on this rule, and you're posting your own video on YouTube that might appeal to children? Does this make you liable for whatever YouTube is doing with their site?
So we do make a distinction between what's a child-directed site and what's a general audience site. So there are certainly lots and lots of sites that appeal to a very wide audience, and a lot of that audience may be children. But we do try to focus on what is a child-directed site. So it's something that has cartoon characters or something that's particularly of interest to children. And I realize that can be hard to distinguish. And someone was telling me about My Little Pony, that when they figured out kind of who was using this site, there were all these grown men, they called them bronies, who liked this. But the thing is, if you are posting something on a general audience site like YouTube, you know, it also then has to be collecting personal information from children, right? It's not just the posting of it. It's that you have a child-directed site that is collecting personal information from children. So that
we've got another caller with a question. Why don't we?
Then I'll step aside.
Okay, well, thank you for your questions. So let's go to our next caller. And again, if you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call.
Yeah, Mrs. Olhausen, you made a reference to the Internet of Things, and could you perhaps explain that a little bit more?
Sure. So how I define the Internet of Things is that you have – so I like to walk through sort of the original view of how you use the Internet is you sat at a desktop computer and you pulled information down, right? You went to a website and it gave you information. Then we kind of moved ahead to much more of the social Internet, the social media, where you individuals were really creating content and sharing it with other individuals. And the way I view the Internet of Things is sort of the next evolution, where humans are cut out of a conversation. So I say that in a joking way. But basically, we have interconnected devices that are communicating through the network back to servers and providing information to them and then possibly getting instructions on, you know, what to do and how to, you know, whether it's for some reason the example that's given all the time is your refrigerator will detect that you're out of milk, right? And it'll send this message back to the server, and the server will send you an email that says you're out of milk. You should pick this up. So, and I always joke, maybe milk is a much more important part of other people's lives than it is of mine, but I'm much more excited about having a wearable medical device that will say, okay, your blood pressure is spiking, and you know, your doctor calls you or you get an alert, or your car automatically reroutes because it detects, you know, the broken down truck on 14th Street Bridge and 395 is becoming a parking lot. But the idea is that it's a bunch of interconnected devices that are collecting and transmitting data to help make decisions about whether what you should do or what your device should do, or whether your and it can apply to many, many things, and also for big data uses. So the Internet of Things, right now, I think Cisco estimated that we could have 1 billion more connected devices. So it's not just, you know, a phone you're talking to, you know, calling home and talking to someone. It's your phone also collecting information when you're not talking on it about the speed at which you're traveling or the ambient temperature or what have you, and providing that information. And this can apply across a multitude of devices. So that's how I think of the Internet of Things.
We've got a couple minutes left. Let me make a call for a final question, if there is one. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Well, Commissioner, I don't see a final question. Let me give you a minute or two to express any final thoughts you have or wrap up if you'd like to.
Sure. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate the chance to talk to everyone and the good questions that I received. Privacy and data security, these are all very important areas for the FTC, and we continue to play a very active role on enforcement and policy research and business guidance, consumer education. But one of the things that I really encourage is for interested parties to, you know, reach out to us, to talk to us. I try to really have an open door policy to hear about what are your concerns, where are we off base, or where could we be doing more or better kinds of work, or is there, you know, something we're missing that we should be hearing about. So I definitely appreciate the opportunity to speak with everyone. We have a very good FTC website. It just got updated, ftc.gov. We've got lots of materials there. Speeches, reports, enforcement actions, business ed, consumer ed are all available on it. So I encourage people who are interested in these topics to look further on the FTC website and to, you know, tell us where we're right and tell us where we're wrong and tell us what we're missing.
Well, Commissioner Olhausen, thank you. On behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank you for your remarks today and taking so many different questions from so many different people. We look forward to having you back in the future at your convenience. Whenever you've got something you'd like to announce or talk about, think of us as a forum, please. And to our audience, I invite you to join us for our next Teleforum conference call. That's going to be hosted tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern Time at this same number. Then we'll be discussing recent changes to the filibuster rule in the U.S. Senate. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.